Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination. Hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Hello and welcome to Taxi Jack. I'm Tom Howell, rookie on the board. SP Futures up 37, NASDAQ Futures up 158 as we're trying to bounce here on the 25th anniversary of 9/11. Wow. Long time ago, but remembered vividly by just about everybody, I would think. Kevin with us?
Good morning.
How are you?
I got a voice. That's a deluxe thing.
Oh, yeah. I can't imagine a teacher and a pontificator not having a voice. What's the point?
You know, the real challenge was Tuesday when it was at its worst. We went with a lot of video and small group activities, so that took a lot of pressure off. But there were times when, you know, I might as well have been a puppeteer up there talking, just trying to draw them out or playing charades. So it was a challenge.
You see, now, if you go in the saloon, where things, you know, are pretty much old-fashioned, all you have to do is like, point to your drink for another one. And when you want the check, you just give the old check sign, and you're good to go. But what do you do, like, in the Dunkin' drive-thru?
You don't go to the Dunkin' drive-thru.
Ah. So we're better off with the old style when you don't have a voice. Yeah, just
make,
saying.
Make your own damn coffee.
Yeah, well, there you go.
The other thing is they walked into having a big display on the board that says, I have laryngitis, I can't talk very much. You know, I sort of laid it out so that I didn't even have to tell them. It was just up there.
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's I guess, you know, they would have known if you opened your mouth and nothing came out. You know, they'd have figured it out, I would hope.
Yeah. Hey, I want to bring up a very important topic. You know, I've talked about it before, and I think you know, some listeners will recognize how much disdain I have for people who put junior on the back of their jerseys in sports. So, you know, it would be like, you know, if somebody...
What if you were a junior?
Well, wait a second. Just give me a second. If you had a son with the same name, Thomas Howe Jr., is that son Howe Jr., or is it Tom Jr.?
I would think it would be. By the way, I am a junior.
Oh, you are a junior. Okay.
But nobody ever used that. It was never...
Yeah, if you put Howe Jr. up there, is Dan Howe something? Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Since I never used it, I don't know the protocol.
It's just stupid because of that. And it's not like we should be concerned about confusing the athlete with his father.
We're talking about a group of people that want to be noticed, Kevin.
I understand. Yeah, and even if you had the very incredibly rare circumstance of the Griffies both playing at the same time on the same team for 1 year, they have numbers to break the tie, just in case anybody's not sure which one is which.
What if you were, you know, you're right. I have a question for you, since I don't know the protocol. My great uncle, who actually was married to my grandmother first before my grandfather, then he died in an electrical accident. He was Thomas Patrick Howe, as was my dad, as am I. Now, am I the third or not?
You're the third.
Even if it's not a grandfather or somebody.
Yeah. In fact, if you remember our buddy Walt, he was Walter C. Szymanski II, His father was Walter Szymanski, but not C.
Ah.
His name was different. So he was the second because his grandfather was the first.
So I could really confuse them if I ever was good enough to play anything. I could just be Hal 3, and they'd say, who the hell is that, above his number?
Yeah, then why bother? It doesn't help or clarify anything. Now, the reason I bring that up is...
Now, if I use the three I's, would anybody even know that those are Roman numerals in today's world?
I don't know. For the third try, the reason I bring that up is because it's also very common for people to go by, if I had a son who was my junior, and maybe my name were Kevin Patrick O'Neill, which it's not, my son might go by KJ, as in Kevin Jr., not KP. Okay? So, the reason I bring this up is the Cubs have brought up a guy from the minor leagues, BJ Murray Jr. His full name is Bertram Gerard Alonzo Murray Jr. But he goes by BJ, as in Bertram Jr. So BJ Murray Jr. is actually Bertram Murray Jr. Jr.
Well, when you say he goes by, having never had kids, I shouldn't be somewhat critical, but I always have an opinion, it seems. When people name their kids, they give them this name, don't they understand that they're going to go by whatever their friends decide to call them and shorten it by? How do you know that he goes by that, and just when he got to school, there wasn't a kid with a couple other names somewhat similar, and that's what he ended up with?
Well, it could be, but the family name has always been BJ for him, and that's
really?
That's
okay.
What he does. And his growing up in school, his friends probably all knew him as BJ.
Yeah, well, what's?
And that's not unusual. I've known a PJ. I've known lots of people who make the junior. They build it into the name like that, which just sort of accentuates the absurdity of calling him BJ Murray Jr. and of putting Murray Jr. on the back of his uniform.
Well, what about PCA?
What about him?
Well, does anybody really think you're going to refer to somebody by three names?
Only in school.
I don't know of anybody who did that in school. Everybody was a first name.
What's PCA stand for?
Was it Pete Crow Armstrong?
Yeah, he has a hyphenated last name.
I thought, is this one of those where the mom's last name was Crow?
Yeah.
But he's not a politician, or he's not like in the Bush family or something.
They're both, his parents are both actors.
Ah.
Okay. And so they hyphenated his last name, but he grew up as Pete.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, anyway. So where were you on 9/11?
All of this stuff of putting, juniors on there, I don't understand the designation. And then people will constantly, the announcers will constantly refer to him as Murray Jr. Just call him Murray. fine.
So where were you in 9/11?
Actually, there's a bit of a story to that. Bob Golden and I had spent the weekend in Lincoln, Nebraska. We saw Notre Dame get curb stomped by the Nebraska Huskers. That was the Bob Davie years. And we flew back on Sunday. But while at the game, back of the train a little bit, and I'll tell you about the stadium. The stadium was bleachers and two steps per row. So at the end of the bleachers, you had to avoid a half step that was in the way to get in and out of the row. You just had to step carefully. Well, while we were standing, some people up the row, and I was on the end, Bob was second to the end, and some people up in the row got into a shoving match. So they shoved a guy, and this was sort of like dominoes coming down the way. And being the last one there, but nobody fell all the way down until me. Being the last one there, I hit that extra step. And so rather than stepping into the aisle to keep my balance, I hit that step. I tripped, and fell and landed on the corner of the bleacher seat across the aisle. And as Bob told me, the look of pain on my face at that moment was pretty bad. So I had a really sore back. And then, so Sunday we flew home.
The Irish get their ass kicked, you got injured.
Morning, was it Monday morning or Tuesday morning?
I think it was Monday, but I'm not.
Yeah, I think it was Monday. And so I was still sore. So I called into my boss and I said, I have to go see an orthopedic today. I have to get in somewhere and have this examined. I don't expect me to be in. So what happened is I was getting on the phone trying to phone around and find out who would see me, and then my boss, who's the president of the bank, called me back, and he just started saying, okay, here's what's going on, and he started rattling things off like Fiserv's on our big IT service provider is on total lockdown. We are in touch with as many people as we can reach for our treasury department. And he starts rattling this off. And I said, wait, what's going on? He goes, oh, you don't know. I said, turn on your TV. Well, I turned on my TV just in time for the second plane to crash into the towers. At which point I said, I will see you in about 20 minutes. Because I was totally responsible for the bank's disaster plan, all disaster recovery stuff. And so I said, well, you know, we'll worry about the back tomorrow. I'm going to get my ass in there and coordinate activities. And that's what I did for the rest of the day. So that's my where was I story for 9/11.
Yeah, it was, I was in the office early. We had a bunch of people at the time. And I was trading through a joint back office account and managing people's money. So, the thing is, you saw the smoke coming out of the first tower, and they're interviewing people on the ground, and they were talking like it was a Piper Cub that went in there. Some of the interviewers said, yeah, some small private plane just happened to whack into the thing. And I'm going, it's an awful lot of fire for a small private plane. Then you saw the second one pile in, but I had a, I won't say it's a unique experience, Kevin, is that because I had gone to New York a bunch of times for the CBOE, we had cocktails up in the Windows of the World. By the way, what an incredible place that was. This is back in the day when you walked into the Trade Center, got in the elevator, and went to the top and had a drink. You know, now I think you have to, it's an outside elevator, and you have to give them a minimum, and only certain few people go out there, and you got to show all kinds of IDs. I mean, this is back when stuff was, I guess, real. So you go up there, and one of the guys from Smith Barney had a little, well, everybody has a height issue up there. But if you walked to the side of the building, it was a very unusual building, and I'm always kind of interested in stuff like this. Why, I don't know. I'm sure no architect. those places were designed, if you see the Standard Oil building, which is now, what, the Aon Tower or something? You see a regular building, be it the Sears Tower, when I say regular, pretty much a regular building. There's all kinds of internal beams, structure. Well, this place was built sort of like the idea is we wanted these unobstructed floors. So in the middle of the building, you had the elevator tower, which of course is fixed. But after that, there was nothing. And the outside, the beams were very close to each other because the floor essentially hung on the inner stuff and hung on the beams. And if you went to the edge between the beams, you could almost look down because the floors are attached to the beam, and in between the beams was almost like an open space where you could almost look all the way down. And it totally freaked out this guy from wherever firm he was with. And it was very obvious that all the floors were just attached to these beams much narrower than a normal building in order to gain this. So it was very unique construction, but also it was a problem if you had a problem, okay, because you didn't have any internal. I mean, there was a plane flew into the Empire State Building, and you know, other than causing the damage, the place was sort of fine. And as this thing started to happen, and they didn't get any water on this thing, I'm sitting there with this weird feeling. I go, Dr. J was in the room, and I go, John, if they can't get some water on this stuff, this place is going down. And he looks at me, and he goes, what are you talking about? Why do you know? I said, John, did you ever go to the side of the place and look down? I said, if one of those floors goes, it's the floor below it can't hold the weight. It's going to go down. I said, somehow or another, these guys got to get some water on this. Either it's from one building to the other or something. And maybe it was probably impossible. They never did. And sure enough, you never want to be right when you think of something like that, Kevin. But I'm sitting there going, with that kind of heat, that stuff's going to melt. And if it does, there's no way the one floor can hold the weight of another floor. It's not designed to do that. And I'm sitting there. I didn't want to watch. I just didn't want to watch. And all of a sudden, down they went. And I'm going, oh, God. Hopefully, most of those people got out of there, but a lot of them didn't. You know, there was no backup plan other than the actual sprinklers from the bottom to the top and the pumps. There was no water on the roof. There was no way to get from one building to the other with a hose. You know, in retrospect, all that stuff kind of makes sense, but I was sitting there, Kevin, with the most incredible sense of dread. I had a feeling what was going to happen, and then when it did happen, I'm going, you don't want to ever be right. You don't ever want to be right. It's like, and then the stuff, they're just coming out today, this week, talking about how the city and Giuliani and all these people kept telling everybody it was okay to go and work down there, that, you know, don't worry about all the chemical stuff and everything. And I'm, what are you talking about? The place is nothing but plastic computers and everything, and it's on fire. How the hell can anybody go near the place? Yet they told everybody it was okay, remember?
Oh, yeah, and that, you know, that is the kind of thing that should get people thrown in jail for saying things like that.
And, you know, what happened?
Or at least beaten and caned.
What happened to all the valuables that were in all those offices? I mean, it was such a horrible thing. And then you have stupid stuff afterward, and somebody was just telling me how they didn't get their real ID and the license, and how for how many years now they've been after people to get real ID for the driver's license, and not one of those guys got in the country with a driver's license. And yet we got to go get real IDs. I mean, it's really amazing how this stuff evolves, doesn't it? But I really feel for do you think anyone or how many people were in the building and just didn't die, just never went home? Use it as an excuse.
Yeah, they've made, TV shows about that. People who wanted to disappear, I suppose, might have had an opportunity to disappear. Can't imagine that it's a lot, but it might be some.
We had a listener way, way, way back from Ohio. She was a nurse. I don't know how she became a listener, but she told me her brother just happened to make a sales call that morning to Cantor Fitzgerald, and he got killed. Some of the people, the guy who used to be the chairman of the CBOE, got killed up there. He was just visiting. it was a building, and there was a guy, an unsung hero. If anybody had ever been there, and I'm sure it's the same now, the bottom floor underground at the World Trade Center was essentially a city. Were you ever down there?
No, never. I've been down there on Wall Street, but I've never been to the building.
Well, under the ground, first of all, they put this plaza up there, whoever designed the place. So there's a big outdoor plaza. Well, no matter, and if the wind was over like 5 miles an hour, somehow or another it would catch the buildings and fly down to the plaza where nobody ever sat out on the plaza. I mean, but underground, they had the PATH train in New Jersey came in, at least three subway lines, at least. And then when you went down there, if you went down the steps from wherever the street was there, because I used to stay across the street at the, there was a hotel across the street. We used to stay for the SIBO all the time. You'd walk down, if you were going on to go anywhere, you'd walk downstairs and hit one of the subway lines. Well, there had anything in life was available down there, Kevin. The amount of people walking underground there was, you know, I'm talking, there had to be like 40,000 people, you know, some huge number. If you forgot a belt, there was a belt store. If you forgot a tie, there were five tie stores. All kinds of donut places, coffee. I mean, it was an absolute city. And as soon as it happened, some guy, without being told, essentially shut off all the rail lines into the downstairs, and then stop pouring people into the downstairs in a place. And that dude, whoever he was, saved I don't know how many people's lives. Because if they would have kept pouring subway trains into the basement of that thing, can you imagine?
Yeah, it would have been awesome. One of the other really awesome stories to come out of that is the flotilla to get people off of the island, because they closed all the subways and they closed all the bridges and so on, and they had probably at least hundreds of thousands of people stranded, and they just put out a call for anybody with any kind of a boat. Would you come across and pick people up and take them to where they can get home?
Sort of like Dunkirk.
And this was, this ranged from people in their Boston Whalers to people, to some of the ferry companies and people like that. And they got them all off of there. It took a long time, but they got them all off the island.
Well, it was just a horrible, horrible thing. And I still think, Kevin, to this day, I don't know why, what the story is with the Bushes, why they let the plane leave Florida with the Saudi Arabians on it, and why they never really followed up who bought all the puts before it happened. I don't think, there's, law enforcement in this country is a little bizarre, isn't it? It seems like we never want to run these to ground where it's liable to land in the wrong spot, do we? But I never heard of anybody who bought all those puts coming to justice, did you?
No.
By the way, it wasn't just puts.
Well, it's short of the stock, too, right?
There were an awful lot of calls bought on defense companies.
Okay.
And that was in the days leading up to it, and absolutely, and incidentally, for everybody that buys an option, someone sells one, right? I mean, that's the way the market works. That none of this was ever run to ground.
No.
Now some of the there was some look into the later on the puts thing, because of course you can buy a put, but then in order to actually get the money you have to close the contract, right? You have to make the other transaction, and a very substantial percentage of those contracts were never closed. So you could draw the conclusion from that some
what,
of
what do you mean what do you mean they were closed? If they're in the money, they turn on the short stack.
But the closing transaction was not, let's put it this way, if you were one of the guys on the plane, you weren't around to close the contract.
All right, but somebody did.
I understand that. I'm just saying that there is some indication that some of those were opened by the guys either in the planes or whatever have you.
Why the hell would you open up a position and then go kill yourself?
Chief, to me it makes that... You're assuming that people that are going to hijack an airplane and use it as a flying bomb are rational. Okay, that's I think you've stretched.
I hope there's a beneficiary of the account. It's one of us. Actually, I wouldn't want to be on that account. But
I wouldn't either. You'd have a rather serious.
Well, we would. I remember those guys calling here because Dr. J had one of the first study things about people buying puts. And what happened was the reason why it was caught is United is a pretty sleepy stock. I mean, I've traded United for how many years? Once in a while. I very seldom trade it because it never trades. And all of a sudden, United, American Airlines, and all the stocks, they were way above their normal standard deviation number of trades per day. That's why they were flagged. And then John had it flagged. And the SEC kept calling him. Hey, how do you know about this? And he kept saying, "How do you not? It's right there." And what's the matter with you guys?
What do you mean? What do you mean? I had to open my eyes this morning?
Yeah. But I mean, everything can be traced. I mean, the money comes from somewhere; it goes to somewhere.
Well, but that's assuming you want to trace it.
Oh yeah.
It's like so many other things, Chief. How many times Yeah, there's so many. There's so much BS, and remember, it didn't stop after the actual incident. I had a very good friend of mine. I haven't talked to her in an awfully long time. That worked for Cantor, and they had a bunch of AS400s, which was the mini computer kind of thing that everybody used at that period in time. People don't even remember what that computer was.
I do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
These are guys that are in. They had their main office in the 108th floor or something.
Yeah, and anyway, I mean, but for the grace of God, she wasn't based out of New York. She was based out of Chicago, but for the grace of God, she would have been there. So, I mean, oh boy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one, and I remember exactly where I was. I was, when that morning, I was sitting at, I used to have a 2x2 trading console kind of set up on my desk. Now it's one big monitor. Then it was, a four-way thing. And I had CNBC on the TV. This was in my bedroom was also my office in Florida. And first one hits, and I said, "Oh God, who screwed that pooch?" Right?
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting there watching, and a few minutes later, the second one, instantaneously, that's terrorism.
Yep.
I didn't need to know anything else at that point. I was like, "That's deliberate. That's terrorism."
Yeah. Same way I felt about it, Carl. Is there was speculation about whether somebody did this on purpose, like Tom said. Was it a small aircraft? Was it a big aircraft? So nobody was watching it unfold on the first one.
Right.
So there was no way to know what actually hit it. And then maybe it was an accident. Maybe it, was a pilot who had passed out or something. Could have been a lot of things. But as soon as that second one went into it, it was like, oh, no. This is actually an attack.
How long after did the one hit the Pentagon in terms of time? I don't remember.
It was all pretty much it wasn't that long, right? I mean, and then you had the one that went down in Pennsylvania, where the passengers figured out what was going on and said, "I don't think so. We're all dead already. Let's see if we can at least make this better than it would otherwise be." But the other interesting thing, and this is unverified, but I'm reasonably sure it's correct. There were a lot more than that number of aircraft.
I've listened and read pretty intensively that there was a fifth. I didn't know there was more than that.
Well, there were.
What happened to the fifth, though, Carl? There were weather
problems, Chief. So basically, what happened with that day was not a perfectly clear day. You know, it almost never is across the entire country, right?
Yeah.
And so there were two things that happened. One was that there were some weather delays, particularly out west. And then the second thing that occurred was that the FAA guys. There was one guy who saw the original incident, and he instantly ground stopped the entire country. So I don't know if they still have the authority to do that, but this goes back to the thalidomide thing with the FDA when you had that one woman who basically stopped thousands of children from being born with their hands attached on their shoulder, and. He ground stopped the entire country, and as a result, all of the other attempts never got off the ground. Okay, so...
Oh, I'm reading right here on your favorite thing. The alleged fifth plane was a 767 carrying 50,000 gallons of fuel leaving from Kennedy going to L.A. And the...
Everything was a cross-country flight.
Yeah, flight attendants noted suspicious behavior from a small group of passengers before pushback, leading to ongoing investigations and theories about a targeted hijacking. There's no official government conclusion confirming it was a definitive fifth hijacking attempt. There you go.
Well, I have on fairly decent information there was more than five. But
well, we don't have any idea where this one was headed. Have you no speculation?
No, not really. The obvious intended targets for things like that would either be Chicago or Los Angeles. They already had D.C. and New York, right?
Well, you could have headed for the Congress or someplace.
Well, yeah, there was.
Yeah, well, because the Shanksville flight was supposed to hit a target in D.C.
Right. Right, but we don't know. There's speculation. Was that aimed at the halls of Congress? Was it aimed at the White House? Because you had the one that hit the Pentagon.
Why would you waste a whole plane in a White House? The guy's never even there usually.
Well,
he wasn't.
The one of the interesting things though is conspiracy theorist crazy stuff that's gone around forever started immediately. I spent an awful lot of time in the years, a couple of years after that. At the time, I was in the process of debating whether I was going to stand up a business down in Florida to build diving rebreathers. And so I had finite element analysis software. I was using a Libra instead of SolidWorks because I was doing all of the simulation work and the fit work and the CNC file building and stuff necessary to do the handsets. And obviously, if you have water go into electronics at 300 feet, you're very dead very fast. So that's pretty serious stuff. And the rather unique design that you were talking about, Chief, of those towers meant that the general architectural layout of how that building was constructed was out there in the public. It wasn't a secret, okay, because it was kind of a cool thing, right, and that it was a one-off. So I put a fair bit of effort into essentially running FEA on those collapses. And my instant conclusion, as soon as I started doing some of this simulation work, was that was exactly what it looked like, and exactly what you were saying, and that once the first floor goes, you're screwed.
It was just years before that, they were talking about this boy talking about there was an earthquake in Mexico City,
yeah,
and they were talking about all the floors were just kind of reinforced concrete.
Right.
And if one of them goes, it hits the next floor, the whole place goes. It was sort of the same thing. But, I've always had, and I never really talked to our buddy Dr. Mark about this. It's one thing, if you get people that are, well, I never knew people who were that crazed. Even in politics here, they're not that crazed. That are hateful or something of someone else's lifestyle or whatever it is. I think you could probably find, well, we find people here. We find Timothy McVeigh, there's all kinds of weirdos here that you find to do stuff. But the thought of getting a bunch of males in their 20s and 30s, they look at every day as their oyster, right? To say, we're going to go kill a bunch of Americans. I suppose you could find that if you wanted to recruit hard enough. You probably could find people here to want to kill people. I mean, hopefully not that many. But the idea of, oh, by the way, nobody's coming back.
Right.
I don't know how that would seem to tarnish the recruitment a little bit.
Well, you know,
you would think.
This is one of the unique things about radical Islamic theology. Okay.
We've had bozos here that are going to try and kill people, knowing they weren't coming back.
Well, I understand it, but there's this Valhalla thing about radical Muslim theology. Okay, that you get your 27 virgins in paradise, and they will always be.
Well, I'd rather have a bunch of experienced hookers, but go ahead.
Well, I probably would too. Yeah, exactly. But, you get your 27 virgins. Now, my riposte to this is, what they forgot to tell you is that they're gorillas and they're male. they're virgins, but...
Well, I mean...
Whereas beaks, anyway.
But, Carl, if you're exactly. Catholic like I am, I mean, the idea that there might be a hereafter, and if you're good here, it might be a good place, you might believe that, but you really don't want to hustle it up much.
Well, look at the crazy stuff that has gone on though in other areas. Look at Jim Jones. I mean, Well,
I'm saying it happens. It happens, but it just...
Yeah.
But, I mean, these guys, this guy who ran this thing, he was no dummy. I mean, we're talking about a good-looking guy who probably has any girlfriend he wants, and he's going to... And he was pretty damn smart. What was the guy's name? Otto? He was no idiot. I mean, he was well-educated. I mean, for that guy to say, get 15 people in a room and say, okay, here's what we're going to do, and everybody goes, oh, by the way, we're not coming back. I don't know. It's a mystery to me, let's put it that way.
One of the things that over time, and I have a long article up on the contributor side on my forum this morning on this that took me a couple of days to put together because... You know, it's 25 years, right? So, you know, you go back and you look at, okay, what did you think at the time? And you know, would you have changed any of, you know, today, in hindsight, would you have changed any of your immediate reaction? You know, how pissed off are you about what the government did in response, et cetera? Because remember, we're doing this, you know, rah, 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 nukes right now, right, with Iran.
Yeah.
But remember that Bush did precisely the same thing with Iraq, and oh, by the way, we later found that that was complete and utter garbage, knowingly false. It wasn't a mistake. He and Cheney knew damn well they were lying.
Well, I read it for a little bit. The Brits came out with a summary of that whole mess many years later because they were involved, right? And when Trump bitches at the Brits for not being involved. The reason why they're not involved is because of that fiasco.
Because they knew damn well they'd been hoodwinked.
And in the copy, and I didn't want to read any more of it because I was getting so disgusted. In the copy, they could never get Cheney and the rest of those jamokes to talk about who's going to run the place afterward. All they talked about was cutting up the oil fields.
Well, yeah, of course. But you know, there's, and then you've got this. Gee, as if we, you think we might have, you'd think we maybe should have learned something.
Yeah.
This little situation that we started with Iran last night, the Houthis apparently have figured out how to cut off the exit out of the Gulf into the Gulf of Aden.
Yeah, which is even special.
There's been some rather odd trading activity there too, because one of the things that went along with this was that late yesterday, there was a great deal of speculation, and it wasn't entirely unfounded. There was pretty good reason for it from satellite imagery, that they had managed to blow up the Saudi Arabian's pipeline in multiple locations, that they'd hit it hard enough to literally blow it up. And that was
good.
Well, that was a big part of where that huge oil price spike came from yesterday, okay? Well, somewhere in the middle of the night last night, all of a sudden that, a good part of, not the whole thing, but a good part of that spike collapsed.
Yeah.
All right, that's an interesting thing because I have not heard anything in particular about precisely what that was. But if you look at that situation as we went into the overnight hours, that overnight trade has all been down. So it looks like maybe that was debunked sometime in the overnight.
The two most, I won't say sacred, economically sacred things that the Iranians better not hit, is the Saudi oil pipeline and the Saudi freshwater pipeline from the salination plant.
Right.
Those are the two out of all the place. If all of a sudden that water thing goes down, the whole capital goes under, doesn't it?
Well, by the way, that's not just KSA. The entire Middle East, actually, I think I talked about this on the show a couple of times. Iran actually has the best freshwater coverage of any country in that part of the world.
Well, Iran's not a desert. Iran's Persia. There's mountains. There's everything in Iran.
Right. I'm just saying. Yeah. You know, from rainwater catchment, things like they have their coverage is nowhere near 100%. It's like 50. Okay. But
everybody thinks Iran's a desert. It's not. It doesn't look like Saudi Arabia at all. Well, in some areas it does, but.
Well, in some parts. Yeah. Iran's a very large nation.
Yeah.
But the. The other thing is that if you look at the other nations in the Middle East, without desal, Israel, for example, can only support something like 12% of its people without the desal plants. And so if you blew those up on a widespread basis in those nations, you'd force the depopulation of those countries.
Yeah, and well, it doesn't matter how much money you have, you need a glass of water.
If you can't get a drink, you've got problems. Yep.
Regarding that situation, here's kind of the fatal flaw of the whole thing from the United States standpoint. And Larissa might want to comment too as a business professor, because this applies to businesses and tough economies and so on. Is the Iranians? They're not trying to win. They're trying to just keep the game going, and they're really good at it. And this is a lesson that applied, if you go back to Vietnam and the North Vietnamese Army.
We're just going
to
say Vietnam. No, well,
yeah, they weren't going to win. They were just going to keep everything going until the U.S. got too frustrated and said, "Screw it, I'm walking out of here," which is what happened. It's the same thing that happened when Russia invaded Afghanistan and the Mujahideen. They couldn't beat the Russians, but what they could do is just frustrate them until they get tired of doing it. Tired of this whole incursion, and then they walk away from it. And this is what Iran's doing right now. And it's not, I don't know that Trump really understands anything other than we won, we lost, or we cut a deal where both sides can shake hands and walk away, because none of those are on the agenda for the Iranians. And so this winds up dragging on, and that's just the way it goes. It's the same thing a business would do. We saw that when the businesses that survived the best, when everything got shut down a few years ago, were the ones that sort of creatively said, "How do I just keep my head above water? I don't have to do anything other than just stay in the game."
And get the biggest check from government I can get.
Well, that could be part of it, but it was also people who got, there were restaurants who got creative early on about how to deliver food, get food to people, how to do distribution. There were larger outfits that, that said, "I can't get things in and out of the port of Los Angeles. Well, I can do a 3-year lease on some smaller tanker ships, and I can start getting product through, Port of Seattle or someplace like that, and that can handle smaller tanker ships." So if you remember all the shelves being empty, and all of a sudden some stores like Lowe's and Home Depot and Walmart, they rented their own fleet. That was expensive. It was not a maximum profit play. It was a let's keep our stuff going. And the people who can't handle that, the people who can't do that, are going to fall by the wayside.
Hey, if we have Larissa. Larissa, is this going to be a topic in our class today or at all? Or,
we don't have classes on Fridays.
Oh, I do have classes on Fridays. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, how are you?
I have Saturday morning class, so I'll probably work this into tomorrow mornings. Go ahead, Larissa.
Thanks. Good morning, everybody. I will discuss September. Well, I think you're asking if I'm going to discuss September 11th, correct?
Yes. Class?
Yes. Russell and I had done on our YouTube channel, Academic Markets Insights, we interviewed traders. And one of the things that we did, we have a little thing called floor trade, floor tails. And one of the things that we did was we would ask traders what it was like on that day being at the towers, or not necessarily being at the towers, but just trading in the market. And we've heard from people who were in New York, we've heard from people who were in Chicago, and we've heard from people who were in Philadelphia. And it's a very sobering, humbling experience listening to them talk about just the fear. And again, I know this was just brought up, but we didn't have the ability to watch and to really understand what was happening like we do now. I remember when I was working, I was in Philadelphia, and the gentleman next to me, we were in a cubicle, and he listens to Howard Stern. So we were getting all of our news feed from Howard Stern that day. And again, it's really difficult to understand if all you're listening to is the radio. So I do bring it up in class. I'm teaching investments and the idea of managing risk and trying to not necessarily anticipate a terrorist attack, but understand how the market's going to react, how the government's going to react specifically to the markets. But Kevin, I was thinking about your argument about staying in the game long enough, even if you know you're not going to win. And I think a lot of corporations are very good with this, or some, let me rephrase it, some are very good with this, and they use their lawyers to make that happen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And what a strategy from a legal perspective, even if you know you're not going to win, or the case with Pepsi, where they promised a jet if you had so many Pepsi points. Well, Pepsi was very good at continuing the legal fight until finally the individual just lost. But again, that's the ability to keep fighting.
Take the will to continue away from your opposition.
Right.
Larissa, if you would have not heard just on the radio, if you actually would have stared at the TV and had the TV wherever you were, all you saw for several hours, knowing something really bad was going to happen, is two buildings with smoke pouring out of the middle, wondering how bad is this going to get. It had to be the worst. Guys, wasn't that the worst 2, 3, 4 hours in your life, just sitting there going, something bad's going to happen, what's going to happen? Because there was no attempt to, there was no way to mitigate it at all. You just stood there and watched and waited for something awful to happen. It was terrible.
Oh, it was. So I was in Philadelphia. My father was in Pittsburgh, and you talked about the Pittsburgh flight that went down. I didn't hear from my dad until like mid afternoon, and so we didn't know if he was on that flight. And again, because this is, my dad didn't exactly provide flight information for every business trip he did. So again, we just didn't have any information, and really most of the information is a flight went down around Pittsburgh. And the reason why my father hadn't called anybody is the dumbest reason possible. He was in a meeting. There was about, I think he said 10 to 15 people in this meeting, and it was a 4-hour meeting. Nobody bothered to tell them that this was happening.
You gotta be kidding. It's unreal.
It was one of those, because my dad didn't carry a cell phone in 2001. I don't think I carried a cell phone in 2001. And if you're not getting the news and nobody's thinking to interrupt your meeting to tell you, you just don't know. And so that's something else I try to explain to students, is how technology has not only just changed everybody's lives, but I go back and discuss how it's changed the markets. So our news feed and how quick we're able to respond to things that are actually happening is substantially different than it was 25 years ago.
Well, some of the dudes that made out the best were like across the street that were evacuated. When they saw the plane flying, the first thing they did before they left was sell spooze.
Ooh.
Because nobody else had the feed, but they did. It was right outside their window. Right. And they sold spooze and dashed.
Sure.
There was something else that happened, too, that was this kind of interesting story. And that is, we grounded flights for a week. And so what would happen? What would happen to check clearing, which at the time was all paper-based, and all got flown around the country, and that stuff didn't get off the ground. So if I had sent Carl a check, for example, were you in Florida at the time, Carl?
Yes, I was.
Okay, so I would have sent Carl a check, my happy birthday Carl check.
Yep.
And he deposited it, and you would get credit for it. Same day, next day, whatever it was going to be, you were going to get credit for it. But it never found its way to my bank until the planes started flying again and they started getting, you know, gradually getting the checks there. Well, roll that up for all of commerce in the United States at the time. All the stuff that was being done by writing checks for accounts for payables, receivables, et cetera, and all of that. And so what do you suppose happened to the Fed's ability to monitor the money supply that week?
Well, yeah, that'd be a small problem, right?
Yep. That is a very small problem. And the result of that was the legislation that, you know, the short version name of the legislation was Check 21.
Right.
But it became an implementation because, you know, image technology for banks existed at the time and it was being used, but it was considered expensive, something only the big banks would do. And there were some productivity gains from it and so on, but it wasn't widely implemented. Well, now everything is transmitted. You know, everything is captured at the point of deposit, and it's transmitted through the Fed electronically. So, you know, it wouldn't happen again that way now, but it did at the time.
Well, go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing that a lot of people, well, some people know about it was reported at the time, but of course it was not widely reported, and nobody ever hanged for it, was that Bush allowed over 100 Saudi citizens out of the country on private flights while our airspace was locked down. By the way, a number of them were Bin Laden family members.
Well, what was
I remember that.
Yeah, I don't.
We're not talking about a couple of people here. We're talking about over 100.
Yeah, and he never had to answer that.
Never had to answer for that. Nor did anybody ever answer for the fact that a couple of the hijackers were renting a room from a known FBI informant. Okay, in the months before, they were taking flight lessons. The flight lessons that were taken all over the country, including the ones by people who didn't want to know how to land, that were renting simulator time. A couple of those guys called the FBI and said, hey, we got a bunch of people that appear to be a little nuts. They're paying in cash, and they have turbans on, and are bringing prayer mats, and just they're paying in cash for simulator time, which is not illegal to go into a commercial simulator and buy time on it. However, they don't want to know how to land the plane. That's a little odd. Maybe you ought to look at that.
It never got off anybody's desk.
Nobody ever did a blankety-blanking thing. And yet, you know, then you have the entire TSA fiasco, which incidentally begat the current situation with electronic ticketing, which made it... Prior to all of this, you could frank tickets back. I spent a good part of the last couple of years in the 1980s and the first couple of years in the 1990s. I was a wage slave before I ran my own company. And one of the places I worked for, we had contracts with a firm in Norcross, which is just north of Atlanta. And I was back and forth between O'Hare and Hartsfield sometimes twice in 1 week. Needless to say, that could suck bad, right? And so I knew every single way to not get stranded. Getting stranded in your home base is not all that big of a deal. Getting stranded on the other end is a huge problem. And back before all of this insanity, you had a paper ticket, and if you knew how to read it, you knew how much it was worth if it was franked back to the issuing airline. And as long as they had an open seat and you were at that door a couple of minutes before it closed, they would take that paper ticket from you, even if it wasn't the same airline, as long as it was going to the same place, because they could frank it back to the original carrier and get something for it. And that seat was worth something to them.
Well, at one point they were all the same price, so they didn't care.
Well, these were not, yeah. Okay? But the point being, if the door's about to close and that gate agent takes that ticket from you, even though it's not from their airline, it's worth $50. If you get on the plane and you sit in the seat, they get $50. If they tell you to bite it, which they can do, they have the right to do it, it's not their airline, it's not their, you're not ticketed on that flight. If they tell you to bite it, they don't get the $50. Well, if the door's about to close, what do you think they're going to do?
Well, you know,
Yeah, you're going to get on. And so as long as you don't have to check bags and you can
You guys don't remember. Certainly, yeah. Larissa does not. The days before deregulation, if you had a United ticket and the plane was a little late and there was an American plane leaving, you just walked over and they took it. Well, they were all the same price.
That is precise. Well, but in truth, it didn't have to be the same price, and it wasn't, as long as your destination was going to the same place. And there was... Chief, I can't tell you how many times I did that at Hartsfield. Okay,
well, You did it all the time. We're all the same prices. One was leaving and one wasn't.
Yeah, well, I mean, something's wrong with the plane. There's a weather delay, but whatever. This plane's leaving. That one's not. Or the other thing that was very common and used to all time is okay. You know, I'm expecting that. This work is going to last until 5 o'clock. Then I got to get down to the airport. Norcross, by the way, is north of Atlanta, which makes it a whole lot of fun because even then the traffic was stupid. And so you're like, all right, so I got a 7 o'clock flight out back to O'Hare, which kind of sucks because then, you know, you get in and the next morning you got to go to work, right? All right, well, guess what? I get done at 3. So I would get my ass in the rental car, get back down there, turn it in, go there and look at the board. Okay, who's leaving? What's the next flight out of here, right? And go stand at the gate and 2 minutes beforehand, and I'm 95% of the time I'm in that airport.
Well, yeah. Well, he also presupposes that the wing you're in is not 90 million miles from the other wing where the next plane is. So the rest of you guys are going to discuss it a little bit today. 25 years seems like a while, doesn't it, guys? It doesn't seem like 25 years ago. You remember stuff like this so vividly. What else are you guys going to talk about in terms of the trading parts of it, Larissa? I mean, there were people that bought puts in advance, which, you know, we were privy to here because, you know, they were calling Dr. J all the time because he was talking about it on Fox. And of course, they were listening, and they go, hey, how do you know about all this stuff? That's an interesting story for your class someday, actually. Because they were calling here looking for them. How do you know about this? And yet they didn't really have any way of tracking stuff, they claim. And yet every time, I mean, I'm majority owner of a brokerage firm, I know how hard it is. Larissa, if you open up an account here, we have to check you out at Interpol. The money that comes into the account, by the way, we're not going to take cash. It better come from a bank account with your name on it, or it's not getting in. And the money has to go back to a bank account with your name on it. We could send you a check only to your home address that's here, it's on file. The idea that you can't trace these people is so bizarre to me. I mean, every no matter what it is, we used to do a lot of work for actually the Crown family, but they cleared some other place. But they liked our execution. So we had what they call a CMTA agreement. So the minute we did a trade, it immediately flipped to Stiefel Nichols where their trade was. They call it trading floor a flip. It's a flip from one firm to the other, an overnight clearing, but it's still all traceable. I mean, I don't see when somebody comes out and says we can't find these guys. I think you don't want to find these guys, and then, I mean it's very accusatory. But what are you guys going to talk at all about? And actually, the same thing. On a smaller scale, happened before Hamas invaded Israel. That October 6th, was it 4 years ago now or something? There were puts bought in some industries, and Carl probably would say there's calls bought in the defense industries. I mean, there's always front running on something. I don't think they ever got run to ground either, but I don't know. You know, I don't know about Israeli justice system that much, but somebody knew. When you guys talk about that in class, what do you say about it, Lucy? You don't talk about it.
Well, particularly today, I won't be talking much about it. We are going to be building out the efficient frontier, and today the slope of the tangent line of the efficient frontier, the capital allocation line, is going to meet, and we're going to find our optimal risky portfolio. So, students, if you're listening, you're in for a treat. But because of the learning objectives and how quick the class goes, it doesn't allow for a lot of discussion of outside or what current events. I try to incorporate it as much as I can, but it has to be tied to the learning objectives of the day.
What kind of frontier? You got me all interested now.
The efficient frontier.
It sounds good. How do we get one of those?
Well, it is the theoretical framework for building out the capital allocation model.
Of anything, or for businesses or government or anything you want to do?
So the capital allocation pricing model is what's used to determine the return of equity.
Okay.
And I enjoy the math behind it. So
do you guys use net present value, or do you use rate of return?
So this is, if you're thinking about like net present value, this is trying to determine the return of equity that's embedded into that net present value. So this would be a portion of the discount rate that we're generating.
What does the move in, who knows what's going to happen today with the CPI, but the PPI yesterday was a shot in the behind, shall we say. The number, I don't know if you looked, the number yesterday was 0.4, but if you dug under the covers even a hair, you found that the goods part was 1.1, which is a big So I'm you know, without casting aspersions, I think people all night long trying to find out a way to keep the CPI number down, because I don't know if you guys talk a little bit about money supply, but 6 months ago, 5 months ago, we had an annual bulge in money supply of like 11%. Well, if you use old monetary theory, which you're not supposed to use now, you're supposed to use the new stuff, use the old theory, the it takes 4, 5, 6 months to get through the system. So this month, next month, and maybe the month after that, should see a bulge in the CPI, which you saw in the PPI yesterday. So if we get the same bulge in the CPI, long story short, the 10-year, if it got through 4.5, and we talked about this, Larissa, if it got through, that was the number everybody was afraid of, right? Well, then it went through 4.5. Then the next number, now you're supposed to be afraid of 4.8. Well, last night it closed at 4.94. So if that were to go through 5% today, what does that do to your model? I mean, what interest rate are you guys using?
So we're building the model.
Okay.
So we're not using the model. It should have an impact on the overall discount rate that we're looking at. But right now, what we're focused in is how does it impact the equity portion of it. So this will impact, and again, these are undergraduate students. So in this development, and again, we're even not even modeling, just building out the theoretical framework for how to model. And we would have to discuss how to expand the model to incorporate things such as inflation and interest rate changes, because right now the model that we're looking at doesn't incorporate these things.
Okay.
And again, you have to remember that these students have to start somewhere, and this is where they're starting.
Well, it sounds like it's incorporating a lot of stuff. It's going to make them think. That's the idea, right?
I hope so.
And are they
don't like thinking, but, you know.
are they picking most of it up? I mean, is everybody, I'm going to say pretty bright? I mean, Purdue doesn't get a schlump in the place. I mean, you guys are going to get good kids. I mean, do they pick this stuff up sort of like you would expect?
They, I think, are picking it up how I would expect them compared to other undergraduate students that I've seen. Purdue does have very good students, and I have a handful of students who are really picking up this stuff. But it's a theoretical framework, and I think that's very difficult for undergraduate students who have never had to think about theoretical frameworks. Most of them, they've been able to be given the closed-end solution and been able to plug and chug to get their answers. And in this course, they don't have that luxury.
Is the final exam throwing a project at them and asking them if it's worthwhile, or is it just the model?
Oh, no. It's a written exam with multiple choice questions. And I know we've talked about the CFA exam before, and it is modeled after what a CFA exam would look like.
Okay. That's what I'm... Since I was I was an analyst, I'm supposed to have taken that test, but I never did because I didn't have it.
Well, sure. But I want my students to be prepared so that once they graduate from undergrad, that they would be in a position to be able to take that exam and be able to discuss these things in an interview. And I try to make the argument to them that during an interview, people are going to ask you, how are you going to price something? And they want to hear your logic. How do you think things through? It's more than just, can you regurgitate the formula? But really, how would you expand a model? How would you incorporate different things? What are some sensitivity areas that you're concerned about? And that's what I'm trying to push them to be able to do, is to really think about those things. And they don't like me. They don't like being forced to think about these things, but I know in the long run it's good for them.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the sensitivity stuff, and I ranted to Carl for a while last Friday. He let me get on my soapbox for some reason, because I used to do a lot of that stuff when I was an unofficial analyst. I didn't take the test, and it always struck me when you're talking about any kind of big project, be it a building railroad cars, whatever it is. I mean, I'm sure, God, if you're doing something for the military, it'd be 10 times harder. But it always struck me that if anybody did the estimate properly, you could absorb a 4-month strike. You could absorb any one or two big hits. But if you got 5 or 6 little hits, they seem to compound way more than the big hits, which was not intuitively obvious until you went through them. And I'm having that really bad feeling about the economy right now. A lot of little stuff seems to be happening that if you just look at that one variable, you might say, eh. But now, you know, we're talking about interest rates, we're talking about deficits, we're talking about, people seemingly not even looking at some of this stuff. And when you talk about other countries that normally you wouldn't care about, well, you care about everybody, I hope, but you wouldn't care about, you know, Japan having a problem until you look and see, well, gee, we owe those guys $1 trillion. All of a sudden, it seems like the little arrows are starting to come from a lot of different directions, and it has me very worried. I don't know, is that something I should be worried about, Professor, or not?
I'm worried about those things, so I don't know if that helps.
We'll get Carl to talk you both off the ledge.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
He's an optimist.
Yeah, Carl's our biggest optimist.
Yeah, I'm optimistic it's all going to go to hell.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
This interest rate move, the amusing part of this is that Bessent, everybody seems to think that he's some kind of god, and of course, being that he's Treasury Secretary, he has a big bazooka he can threaten to use, right? Okay. The facts are that he blew up two of Soros' funds. So, for those people who think he's so smart, if he's so smart, why did he fail twice? And then, by the way, Soros pulled his funding and basically ejected him from his orbit because he wasn't making money. He was losing money repeatedly.
Yeah.
that's usually a sign that something upstairs isn't meshing with how the real world works. But the other aspect of it is that, Chief, and you've seen this 1,000 times, all right? I've seen this probably 100 times. Anytime you stick something like this in front of the market, it is exactly like walking out into the ring with an angry bull there with a big red cape and waving it around. All right, the market is going to turn around and say, "Oh, really? You think so? By the way, buddy, your butthole looks interesting." So I think this is
not how I would have worded it, but cool.
Well, I just think it's fascinating that this guy seriously believes that he can horse something around that is bigger than any nation, all right? And stock market, you can play all kinds of games with. Anybody that has spent any time trading, the first thing you learn is the stock market is a fly on the horse's butt. The bond market is the horse, and FX is the asteroid.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay, I mean that's just the way it is. So that he thinks he can wave this stuff around and just have everything be whatever. I have, you know, look, we got 15 more minutes before this CPI number, you know, hits the tape. I think it comes out at 8:30.
Yeah, we're going to go to break a little early so we're going to be around when it comes on.
Yeah, and
I mean a minute early, not now. So.
Well, and the thing is that the PPI number that came out yesterday, the internals in there were absolutely hideous. So I don't know what people are expecting, but and incidentally, we had a huge fuel price spike yesterday here. I understand it's everywhere. It wasn't just
this morning. We're instead of being $3.99 on the gas stations to go look for, it's $4.49.
Yeah, there was a very large spike yesterday, which I went out to have a beer after I got done with my stuff yesterday afternoon, and I was like, what was that about? We went from, because we typically have very, very decent price here from a standpoint of you know, everything when it comes to fuels. Yeah, not so much. I'm on my way down to the bar, and I go by the gas station, it's $3.94, and it was like $3.40. yesterday.
Well, I took Mr. O'Neill's advice. I actually was driving through Indiana last weekend. It was $3.39. Fill up the truck.
Well, that was I mean, I've got full tanks, so I'm good for the time being. But I got that.
Larissa, I'm gonna let me interrupt there a little bit. I'm gonna push back on Carl just a hair regarding Mr. Besant in his ilk, for lack of a better term. If you look before COVID, or you look when we were doing the 1.5% 10-year rates, Larissa, I would have said it was very similar to when I started the business, and I don't want to drop a year on it, but for anybody who knows any history, the Dow was about 800, right? So in my first year, the interest rates were 16-15%, and the trade that was just there right in front of you was, for God's sake, the market, you got to buy the market, because we're going to go under as a country if they stay here, so that's not going to happen. It's going to go the other way somewhere. But it took 18 months for that to start. And, oh, by the way, the market went down another 20%, even though the rates had gone from, CD rates had gone from 16 to 12.5. So it was already happening. But people were so convinced that the market was not a place to be that it still went down. Okay, so now when this happened with the COVID situation, and I'm going to say I'm not congratulating Besant and his creatures, but I'm saying I think this might be why they think this, and I'm asking you to be the referee. If you would have looked at where the Fed, say the 10-year rate was 1.5, well, the single most obvious trade since 1981 was these things are going up. I mean, come on. I mean, they're not staying here, for God's sake. But I probably did that for my clients, shorted bonds, literally, because that's how you do it. I probably did that 20 times, and maybe I think I made money more than half, but like 11. I mean, we were a little up for the whole fiasco. Every single time it became obvious you had to short these bonds, those bozos went out and bought the bonds to the point where they blew the balance sheet up by, I think they started at $2 trillion. Where did they make it, Carl? 7.5. I never, in my wildest dreams, thought that they would, talk about a bazooka, that they would bring out a missile like that just to keep those rates down. They essentially lobbed them out there for people to buy, and then they turned around and bought them right back. You would never have dreamed any sort of legitimate government would do something like that. And this went through both presidencies, by the way. So when these guys come out and talk about this crazy stuff, I pay attention. I mean, it may sound crazy to me, but they just might do it. I mean, Larissa, talk me down from this ledge. They just might. It seems like these prices are going up. It seems like you got to bet on these interest rates going up, but you better be careful. I mean, it's some of the fun, because these guys are liable to pull any sort of stunt.
Yeah, I can't talk you off the ledge. I'm sorry. Usually I'm a little more even killed about these things, but we've seen weird things that the government has done to attempt to mitigate fluctuations in the market. I keep thinking back to like 2008 when we had that huge liquidity crisis and we went with quantitative easing, and then we ended up with the liquidity trap because you could only do so much quantitative easing. I don't put it past the government to do something to try to continue to manipulate the markets in such a way. And I don't understand. I think part of it is that the government is really trying to protect, I hope, they're trying to protect the American people. And it's like they don't want the market to correct itself naturally. They want to artificially manipulate the market for whatever purposes that they have. And I guess I believe in natural consequences and for the market to right itself. And I believe in free markets. And I think we miss out on opportunities because the government doesn't want some of those natural consequences because they could be very bad.
Well, they're also, without going to a huge thing, but they're involved. I mean, if you push the inflation rate to 10%, these guys are going to make money on it.
Mm.
I mean, the mortgage is a derail now becomes less and less of a percentage.
Chief, you have to watch it, though. I know you run this one all the time, right? And you bring up Weimar and, you know, the farmers there and stuff like that. There's a problem with this, and that is that, and you know this because you're a trader. Everybody that has an asset, this is the first thing in double entry bookkeeping.
Yep.
For every debit, there's a credit. For everyone who gets this, someone else gets it in the butt. And the problem with doing this is, and this is one of my primary arguments, the primary function of government. Leave everything else. So if government does nothing else, we're talking about even in front of national security, the primary function of government must be to prohibit and punish larceny. And it makes absolutely no difference how much is being larcened, how much is being stolen. The amount is immaterial, because if you do not punish larceny and punish it evenly and punish it every time and make it unprofitable to do, there are always going to be jackasses in the world.
That ship is away from the dock, bud.
Well, it may very well be, but if we do not reimpose this discipline, then when you run out of margin, and the people that you can squeeze like this, you're stealing a penny at a time, but by God, you're doing it to all 330 million Americans, and you're doing it one every single day. When you run out of margin on that, you get violence.
Well,
we are in that situation now where the margin is gone.
Well, I would agree with that 100%. You know that. But I want to run one by Larissa, probably has been on a Friday long enough. But what Carl brings up a lot, one of his... By the way, if I don't get a chance, I will, when we're talking about the CPI numbers, that thing you sent out about AI could have been the best thing I've ever read from you. I hate like hell to say that to you because I know it goes right to your head. But
oh, there you go.
But I thought it was spectacular. But anyway, if anybody hasn't read it, but my point being is that Larissa Carl brought up the thing that I'm supposed to know this stuff because I'm this monetarist, right? That some people were able to borrow underneath the inflation rate, and Hal is all over this because he's done a lot of studies on it. Our other professor, and if you look at the places where people have actually been able to borrow less than the asset price going up, the stock market, okay, because you can borrow, even if it's 6% as your margin rate, and it was less than that for a while, market's gone up more than that. Certainly in terms of housing, you could have got a mortgage 5 years ago at 3%. The houses are up 20%, 30%, right? So I mean, so those areas, people have done amazingly well. I would bet your students would absolutely hate this. I don't know if I can even do this anymore, but I used to be able to do stuff like this. I could walk in and say, and put stuff up on the blackboard, which they don't have anymore, regarding renting versus owning. And you could seriously make the case in an economy in equilibrium of any kind that there would be no advantage over a period of time in renting versus owning, that at some point the ownership would drop to the risk-free rate or with a plus the risk factor, and over a period of 20 years you wouldn't have the owner being richer than God and the renter absolutely gagging on like somebody's guarding his throat. That should never happen in an economy that is somewhat at equilibrium and is free. And yet it has, hasn't it?
I mean, I've never really done that comparison of renting versus particularly in the long run of renting versus home ownership. I think a lot of Americans generate their wealth from their home.
I agree, but I'm saying we're talking about but if the inflation isn't there, I mean, when I was she used to be a contributor to the show. She died in an accident a few years ago. We were boyfriend girlfriend for a long time, and her friends in her Jewish group, and her friends from New York, her dad's friends, all these guys rented for like 30 years, 40 years. They never, we're talking 1978. They never felt like they were getting screwed. They had other things to do with their money. They invested it. They had businesses. They didn't over a long period of time, all of a sudden the rents went up, you know, five times the inflation rate and the price of the building went up that much. And if you were the owner, you made out like a bandit. And if you were the renter, you just got, you know, you got it where the sun don't shine. That's a sign of an unhealthy economy, I think. I couldn't do it, but Milton Friedman, those guys, could actually tell you that that's a sign of an unhealthy economy. It shouldn't be that way. I mean, granted, if the guy, you know, the guy who runs the place should be making, you know, 7% a year or 6% a year on his rents. He deserves something for owning it. There's a return there. But should the place he bought 20 years ago for $1 million be worth $9 million? I mean, where does that come from? Unless you're talking about degrading the currency, which we've done. I know I'm on a rant there, but just saying. And why the people that we got a break here in a minute. The people that Audrey now is my girlfriend does, you know, she does the on the show and she does real estate. Virtually all of her deals now are cash deals, and these are people that bought a home 20 years ago and for whatever 150, it's now 500. Or 550 or something, and now they're looking for a place without you know, without steps. They're getting older or whatever. All these transactions are now cash. And how is it that if you look at the inflation rate from 20 years ago, I'm going to say the house should have gone up, maybe doubled, maybe 225 or something, and it's gone up, you know, four times. Because the dollar's worth that much low. Well, government has done that to people. They've picked winners here. And the winners are the owners. And the guys that are in power, they're the shareholders now. They're the owners. So they're not worried about you and me necessarily, I don't think, because they're in the game. I know that's a little... Am I talking too much here? Larissa, tell me. We went on a break, but... I mean,
I also think you're ignoring the fact that the economy has expanded substantially. So there's just so much more wealth overall in the economy due to the improvements in technology, in ability to generate more profits. And because we have so much more wealth in the economy, people are, and there's a limited, just there's limited land and there's limited physical, you know, location for your home. There's limitations around that. I think you're missing that some of these homes, if they're in the right spot, there's a substantial amount of demand, and the prices are going up because people have access to more money. So people, again, have, as the economy has expanded, and we have gone through some substantial bull markets, and that's created an extraordinary amount of additional wealth overall in our economy, which is what's also helped push up those prices for homes.
Well, by the way, it's out.
Yeah, we got to get the number here. We got to shift into our CPI mode, everybody. What do you have? I've got
I got 0-4 on the month in total, which by the way is hot. Index for gasoline up 3.9% in August. This is going to be massively worse for in next month. Diesel has of course shot the moon in the last 3 weeks. So that's God. Yeah, energy is going to be ugly. The last month's energy index up 2.1, shelter up 0.3, which is a tripling from the 0.1 in July. Food up 0.1, but that one and food away from home up 0.3. So and all less food and energy up 0.3, which is an acceleration from last month's 0.2. So this. Anybody that thinks that the report was going to come in a little cool and was going to give Warsh some cover,
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of these numbers, as you run down them, they're small pieces, but you question them.
But some of it's BS.
Motor vehicle insurance down 5% from last year. I got a bridge for you if you think that's going down.
Well, I'll tell you where that probably came from, because I happen to be a State Farm customer. State Farm issued their mutual. If you're in their main, not their fire and casualty company, but if you're in their main insurance company, that's a mutual company. So they actually issued the checks back to the policyholders last month. I got one.
Well, I'm supposed to get mine too. $45.
Well, I mean, I got mine.
Okay.
So I mean, that's a one off. But on the other hand, what that basically means is they screwed you last year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but 0.4. What's the lead time on the PPI into the CPI?
So it's somewhat variable because the PPI, of course, has both finished goods, the headline number, and then you have the intermediate and crude and multiple stages contained within there. You're going to see the start of that that heat show up in the CPI next month, and it's going to continue for the next 4 to 6. So, yeah.
Larissa, what's your comment? We're at the 0.4 like everybody thought. So we've got SP futures up 41, NASDAQ futures up 182. So we're making back some of yesterday, actually a good chunk of yesterday. We've got the 10-year. You know what though? These rates, 10 years up another 0.19. So we're 4.96. So,
well, there's a problem here though, Chief, and that is the IRX is up 1.33%. And there goes any possibility that Warsh, the Fed follows the market. The IRX is now out of band on the current Fed funds rate.
What either one of you, maybe Larissa? Why, it seems to me that the 10-year is going up. Not just seems; it is. It's going up a lot faster than the 30-year. Nobody trades a 30-year that much anymore, but it's little interesting too, right?
Not a lot of liquidity there.
Well,
so the 30 is the whole reason I don't pay much attention to the 30 in general is because all the important stuff, at least in the modern world, is priced off the 10.
Well, when you say modern world, is your post Clinton?
Well,
I
get that, but I'm saying that's mortgages are priced off the 10, which by the way is kind of. That's only because the 7 has crappy liquidity, although the average duration, well, not anymore because of the crazy distortion that came from the COVID years. But prior to that, the average duration for a mortgage in an MBS was about 7 years. And so but the 7 has crappy liquidity. So what do you use as your pricing basis?
Larissa, the history of this, going back to further than you want to go, when I first started the business, there were no futures. Stock futures. So if you sat there and traded, you kind of could watch IBM, because if somebody wanted to buy the market, you bought a couple of big stocks. But the thing you watched, the Board of Trade had just come out with the 30-year bond future. So you actually watched the bonds, especially when the interest rates were, 15%. Actually, the 30-year bond, I think, got down to, we talk about a piece of history. There actually is a bond
that is traded. There is a signature bond that is traded.
Yeah, it's a reference, yeah.
And we used to get every month, because I was a Board of Trade member, you get actually a paper copy. If you actually wanted to deliver a bond, Larissa, you could deliver all kinds of bonds, but they all had a factor to them. So if you delivered this particular one, it may be worth 101 cents to the dollar, or another one might be worth 99 cents. So when you delivered, you could make the adjustment. You'd have to, but the actual signature bond was 8.5% coupon, and it traded at one point. I think the low tick was 66, which means the 30-year got to maybe a low of about, or a high tick of about 12.5, 12.75. And when the bonds moved, that moved the market, because if interest rates started to go down, the market started to go up. So if bonds rallied, so did the stock market, until one day somebody decided to have the Kansas City Very Line and then the S&P 500. But it was the 30-year was the king, absolutely the king. And somewhere during, you know, Clinton saying that he actually had a surplus, the Treasury said, we're not going to do 30-year bonds anymore, right, Carl? And then they actually stopped issuing them for 2-3 years. So
the 10 became the reference.
Yeah, became the reference. And then all of a sudden they said, well, we better put the 30-year back out again. It's never really caught, it trades, but not like the 10. It never really has caught the same cachet. But still, if you go back to the old inflation days, which I hope we're not going to get there again, but what you looked at, the current rates, Larissa, were like 16. But the 30-year was 12.5.
Yeah.
So the idea was somewhere in the next 30 years, somebody's going to fix this mess.
Well, if you don't fix it, there isn't going to be a country left, right?
So if the 10-year were to, for instance, pass up the 30-year, like next month or something, it's sort of the same sort of logic, I think, is somewhere in the next, somewhere between 10 and 30 years, we're going to have a government that fixes it.
What I've pointed out to people is that when you see inversions like that, it means you have a 2% problem that you should ignore in terms of the doomsayers, because if it turns out that verifies and the bad comes, all the financial things, all the so-called assets that you have are worth absolutely nothing because a guy two doors down from you thinks that your thigh looks good on his smoker.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, that's just not something that you don't place bets on that. You bet on the inverse of it, because if not, if you're wrong, you don't care.
Well, but Larissa, your students, and I want you to talk here for a second. I'm talking too much. There's a whole different mentality now than when interest rates were that high. You immediately thought, you were just talking earlier about net present value and interest rates and stuff. It was part of your thought process. If I were to say, Larissa, I will give you $1 million 10 years from now, you'd go, hey, thanks for 300, chump. you immediately discounted it. You would never even think that it was, it would be like winning a lottery ticket. You know, if you want it today, it's like, you know, a quarter of what the number is. I mean, but people don't necessarily think that way. And I was wondering, last night we had a cocktail, and I was, what if these rates, you know, this is just all what if. What would you say if you asked your class, what if the 10-year rate gets to 7%? What does that do to Bitcoin? Because there's no interest on Bitcoin, right? Why the hell would anybody want to own Bitcoin? Where if you had dollars, you could put it with the Treasury and make 7%. Once people start thinking in terms of, wait a minute, you want to give me $100 at the end of the year? It's really only worth 90. You're not giving me 100. But nobody thinks like that now yet, do they?
At least my students, they're still struggling to learn through some of these things. And they're starting to get it. And this is a course, or at least I'm teaching a class, that's designed just to help with that.
It seems like for these guys to do okay in this class, they have to learn an awful lot of different stuff. I mean, I love the way you're doing this.
Oh, yeah. It's a hard class. And I make that argument to them, and I let them know that the exam is hard and there's a high probability of failure. So I don't sugarcoat things with them.
When you say failure, you give out Fs?
Yeah.
What happens then if a guy goes takes an engineer takes an economic class and gets an F? what happens to that poor kid?
Well, they either retake the class, or if they get an F on the first exam, they study harder for the second one.
Oh God, I don't think I don't know if I want moms as my as my professors anymore. What do you think, Carl? she's acting like a mom up there. I better learn this or else.
Hey, guess what? If you earn an F, you should get an F.
I suppose. Okay?
That's part of the reason we have the problems we have in this country today, is that we allow people to sit in the pilot seat of an airplane who got an F on their check rides.
Yeah, that's an issue.
Okay, I mean, duh. What'd you just see down in Miami? Yeah, that guy got an F. All right, as proved by the outcome. So there you go.
There was a, which leads me to, I shouldn't do this on the air, but an interesting story regarding that, Carl and Laura. So there was a guy on the trading floor. I hope he's still okay. His name was John O'Connor. When I came to the floor, this guy was the grumpiest old Irish guy I ever came across. He's a broker. And he would give the, that's who you took your course for before you took the exam for the CBOE, right? So John would teach the thing, and then he'd say, well, this one's on the test. Doesn't make any sense, but it's on the test. So some guy would raise up his hand and he'd ask him, hey, what's the story with that question? He goes, I'm teaching this class. I just gave you the answer. I'm due at the bar. What's the matter with you? But anyway, after the floor kind of closed up and he retired from that, he goes to become a driving tester guy for like the state of Illinois. So he's in one of these test facilities. All of a sudden, one of the big muckety mucks from downtown comes out. And he says, Mr. O'Connor, I need to talk to you for a minute. And he goes, why? What's going on? He goes, well, I'm looking here. The rate of failure is like 10%, and you seem to be flunking like 50%. and he goes, is there any reason for this? And I'll clean it up. And he goes, yeah, there's a reason for it. They can't friggin' drive.
Right.
The guy goes, yeah, but we have to do something about this percentage. And he goes, I know what I'm doing. This interview is over. He goes, why are you flunking everybody? Because they can't drive. Is that kind of what you're talking about, Carl?
Well, yeah, but, you know, look, you just had SAPAC. You know, everyone knows about CPAC, right? Well, SAPAC is the Congressional Asia Pacific American Caucus.
Oh, yeah.
Oh boy. You know, every group has a grievance industry, right? That's the world we live in today. Well, these guys are all bent out of shape about the Trump administration making a big stink about the let's just be blunt about it, the Indian problem. And it's real. All right? The fraud in the non-immigrant visa area is off the rack.
Back up a second. Larissa, you know what? We run through this sometime on Tuesday and Friday. What Carl brings up a lot is, you know, whether you worry about the people coming in from Mexico or not, or not, that's another story. But the idea that these visas that you can bring people over to work for a specific company for a specific wage, it might be less than market, but the person here can't go down the block and get another job and get more. It's almost like you're locked in for 2 years in somewhat of an indentured servant sort of
thing.
And
the other problem is that there's all kinds of, there's massive things in the middle of this involving nepotism and actually kickbacks, which have been proved.
Well, whenever somebody is being hired for less than what they're worth, there's room for somebody to get a kickback.
There's a game in there somewhere, right? And so this is something. Now, the Trump administration, you know, I go after people when they do things that I think are stupid, and I give them some praise when they do things I think are smart. The Trump administration is leaning on this, and they're not going at it anywhere near as hard as I would if I was if I was sitting in the left seat. Every one of the companies that were involved in this, particularly firms like Cognizant, there'd be people sitting in handcuffs right now. They'd be in the dock.
Except there might be big contributors. That's a problem.
Well, guess what? This goes back to what I said about larceny in the government's first job, right?
Yeah.
So, anyway. Well,
if you're the larcenous person, it's a problem.
Well, yeah, it is. So, anyway, so SAPAC is now out there saying, oh, you xenophobic, racist, blah, 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 blah. You know, the usual thing, right? Well, guess what? I've been called a racist so many times because I think that we should. What are you going to tell me that now I'm misogynist because I think that Clancy should? We can argue over where she should spend the rest of her life in jail, but whether it's a funny farm or a regular prison, but one way or another, that's what I think ought to happen. Well, guess what? Somebody that commits 20 felonies is arrested 20 times for felonies and let out and then pours a cup of gasoline on top of a woman on a CTA train, lights her on fire. Get a rope.
Yeah, that's a problem, yeah.
And not just for that guy, but for the people who let him out, the other 19.
By the way, Rissa, if I told you last week, you were front and center in the conversation between me and my chiropractor last week.
Oh, no. That's funny.
Because give me 1 second, and I know you got a dash. He was talking about the Clancy case, but it wasn't about. He goes, how is it that I didn't know anything about this, so I just Googled it, and I get a million people that have opinions that aren't in the courtroom. He goes, how does everybody have this incredible opinion where they're fighting back and forth, and nobody's hearing the evidence but the 12 people sitting there? Why can't they just wait and see? And I said, you know, I have a very bright lady who's on my show, and I asked her the question about tariffs. And she said, if you put tariffs up on the blackboard, not one of the kids could take a tariff all the way through from start to finish, yet in 10 minutes they'd all be arguing about it on politics. And so what you say reverberates around. I mean, because it's sort of true. Everybody's got an opinion, even if they're not there. It's pretty scary, isn't it? I mean, you know, there was only one of the ladies wanted to convict. All the other 11 wanted her out, right? It was 11 to 1 not guilty, I think. Wasn't it? Or am I reading that wrong?
Yeah, no, it was, well, yeah, it was 11 to 1. And oh, by the way, the probability stack on this is like insane, but sometimes, you know, Occam's razor is the right answer. There were multiple nurses on the jury. Now, how you end up with multiple people in one specific... I mean, that's
I don't know how that would work, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little crazy. Okay, for those who are unaware, if you're on a jury, you are supposed to use your common sense. Okay? That's part of the instructions. However, it is absolutely forbidden.
But hey, listen, if you got a dash, thank you.
Thank you very much, guys.
As usual, you bring stuff. I'd love to. I'm gonna have to zoom into one of your classes one of these days. That way, I can't throw something at you if I'm only on Zoom.
There you go. Yeah.
But anyway, thank you very much for the insight. As usual, talk at you next week. So keep going, Carl.
All right. So it is. I'm a software engineer, a computer programmer, and I've built networks for a living for decades. Okay, I'm good at these things. If it is perfectly, you can't stop me, assuming that you seat me on the juror, and let's say that the case is about computer fraud and hacking, which I know more than a little bit about, right? Okay, nothing. There's nothing wrong with me in my head in the jury room, going through the evidence, using the knowledge that I have in my field. That's fine. What I cannot do, it is absolutely forbidden, and it is an immediate mistrial if I do it. I cannot use my expert knowledge to explain something to someone else in that jury room. That is expert testimony, and the reason I can't do it is because the other side doesn't get to cross-examine and try to impeach me.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I get it.
All right? It is absolutely out of bounds. And three of these jurors that have been interviewed came out and said that they were using their knowledge as nurses to explain the psychotropic medication argument to the other jurors in the room.
Well,
that's an instant mistrial because you cannot do that.
To piece together what you're saying, and the last time we had a couple weeks ago.
So, basically the bottom line is that the only expert information, the only information in that area that you are allowed to have a communication about is that which was put in front of you during the trial and was subject to cross-examination. That it's in your head is fine. That you attempt to use it to sway the argument and convince other jurors, that's over the line. You can't do it.
Well, the part where this thing walks, and you know, Dr. Jantz was on a few weeks ago, is these drugs are so powerful. And in the industry, the amount of, how can I put this in a trading mantra, the amount of drugs handed out versus time spent with patients seems to be dropping. Is right. that a fair way of saying it?
So that's, yeah. Well,
you know, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I'm just saying, in Dr. Mark's view, if you're going to give somebody those kinds of drugs, it means you better do a person-to-person, face-to-face, I mean, I'm putting words in his mouth, follow-up, you know, once a month for the first 3 months. You don't just do it and hope for the best. And I have a feeling, without, again, not being in the room, so that somewhere along the line, this lady overtook, crossed two together, did something weird, and her husband, who maybe should have noticed it and didn't, or maybe shouldn't have, who knows, you know, I'm talking out of my league here, but somewhere involved here are these drugs that I have heard from many people tend to get misused, overprescribed, doubled up on, with nobody really following up maybe the way they should have. That's not an excuse, yeah. But it makes me want to dig into the evidence and say, who were the doctors? Did they ever see her? What were the signs? Did anybody care? It would make me want to follow up like I do on the show, Carl. I was saying, I don't have an opinion whether the doctor screwed up. I don't have an opinion whether she took half a bottle on her own. But there seems to be some questions here, as usual, that go unanswered, aren't there?
Well, there's always questions that go unanswered, and the, you know, the reality is that our, you know, our trial system is imperfect because humans are imperfect.
If you're gonna rule or decide that somebody killing three kids was because of the drugs they were on, you better take a look at what the hell was she on.
Well, and then,
duh, I mean, Jesus, well, how can, yeah, you not?
Absolutely, but there's problems there too with the narrative that's been presented in the public,
right. Oh,
as
yeah.
well, which are very serious. And this was brought into the trial room, into the courtroom, because I heard part of it. And that is that, of course, after the incident, you know, the cops show up and all the forensics are done and they collect all the evidence and they catalog it and everything else. And yes, she was on, she was prescribed a cocktail of medication over an extended period of time, but she wasn't taking it.
Well, she wasn't. All right. Fair enough. Well, I mean, I don't know. I just brought up the question. Hey,
that's what I'm saying.
All right. We only got 7 minutes. We got to get back to Stocks and Jacks for a second. First of all, how far, and I know we have, you know, people that used to be on the show and maybe still are, that believe these people. And I don't understand what we had President talk about over a trillion dollars he dragged in tariffs. Now, I think he's talking to people that somehow still believe his first thing, that other people pay the tariffs and not them. So he's double doofing whoever he's talking to. But he's talking about $1 trillion. Now, here I am reading, and it's an AI thing, but the federal government collected approximately $300 billion in tariffs and gross revenue from the new sweeping tariffs from Donald Trump.
Now, that's not including the refunds.
Can I get to that?
Yeah, okay.
I'm saying they collected $300 billion and they've kicked back.
I know where you're reading it from because I read the same AI slop.
Okay, but they say they gave back $160, which I think is the number, right?
It's approximately.
All right, leaves them with a net $132.
Right.
And yet President whatever is talking about over $1 trillion, and his second in command lying. They asked him the same question. He goes, yeah, we got over $1 trillion in tariffs. No, they don't. You know, and the part they do have was paid for by you and given back to some people. I mean,
right.
So, but having said that I'm just lobbing that out here. But the other part is we have now eclipsed in the market the entire down day of yesterday. Now, are these numbers that good that all of a sudden everything's okay again, or what are we doing here?
Well, it's interesting. I think one of the interesting
things. We're up 69, by the way, in the S&P.
The reaction off this CPI report, I'm rather surprised. I'm curious as to what AI has determined that this report means that stocks should be priced up instead of being priced down. I'm very curious as to what AI determined that.
For 25 years, it's all the government putting money in the system. Obviously, they're adding money here someplace.
Okay, but where is it? Yeah, but as you know, nothing happens without being able to be traced and found and traced back to source and things like this. Now, of course, there are people who don't want you to do that.
Yeah.
That's rather common. But the idea that, you know, just the fuel price spike in the last few days, Chief, diesel, you put up an article about this.
Yeah, but that's good. That's good if you own Chevron.
It's good if you own Chevron, and it sucks for everybody else,
yeah.
Right? And so, you know, because it's sucking money out of everyone else's pocket. Where is it's like this whole circular finance thing with the AI trade, all right? And then you have this, you know, this stuff coming out that all of a sudden gets every single media outlet is parading these guys that supposedly worked for these AI companies and then resigned. Okay, I haven't seen any vetting on who these people are, where they came from, how long did they work for these firms, who's paying them?
I'm going to put together the Carl article from yesterday, which I've said earlier.
Yeah.
You'll probably argue with me about this too. I think it was one of the best I've ever read from you, because
it
took two different points of view and ran them both. I think, again, I'm just lobbing this one out there as just a guy trying to do some trading for people. I think that your number two, which is, you know, bad
which
people
is it's real
bad. It's sort of real, and bad people are going to manipulate it. I think why these guys are leaving, I possibly could be the same reason why some people are leaving the White House. They don't like the stuff that's happening.
Well, perhaps.
And I'm wondering if, and I don't know that they're going to leave and get their severance pay and say that the chairman is a big crook on national TV, but somehow or another these guys are leaving pretty damn nice jobs, and they're couching into this AI is going to be able to do all this stuff. I think what they're really saying is the people above me are bound and determined to use it for bad reasons, and I'm out of here. I think there's a possibility.
Yeah. And the thing, so one of the things that is troublesome here is that you have people within OpenAI that have, quote-unquote, leaked, stated, whatever, that one of the things that they are doing in-house is, in combination with firms like Palantir and these guys, that their entire business model is to take supposedly anonymized data that you allowed people to collect for advertising purposes, and most of us did consent to that in one way or another, and, you know, to get our discount at the grocery store, whatever have you. These firms exist for the explicit purpose of stripping that layer back off and tying it to you personally, down to your personal identity, where you live, where you work, and everywhere you go, which, incidentally, by itself ought to be a get-a-rope offense, standing alone. And any corporation that builds...
If you got 25 young people in the room, you and I would vote that way, the other people would say, what's the problem?
Well, the other people then need to be on the end of the rope too, all right? So, but the problem with this is OpenAI, it is alleged, has gone even further. They're not just looking at the past. They're putting together artificial models to try to predict who is going to screw with their business in the future, and find ways to get law enforcement to go after them.
Did you hear the two guys on CNBC yesterday were quizzing about this, and the one guy says the problem is you need more AI to police AI. And I'm sitting there going,
Have you ever seen, you've seen the movie Minority Report, right?
Pieces of it.
Okay, well, basically it's the idea that we can determine who's going to commit a crime before they commit a crime, and we can lock them up before they do it.
Well, there's a few people we probably could do that too. But
well, I can think of a few people that probably deserve that. Yeah, but
if you leave the hood in the frosted kitted car, and you got four guns in the car, I'm not so sure we shouldn't grab you sooner. But that's another story.
Well, but the gun was probably stolen. Yeah. So yeah.
But here we've got the S&P's now are up 84. I think, Carl, this is my seat of the pants, and tell me I'm nuts here because you like to argue, and we got to go. My seat of the pants view to this is most people's view, including mine, of well, certainly mine, of what the government is now doing with this midterm election, is they are going to continue to pour money in and get the prices of every asset they can up, and the market is not going to go down before the election. Something like yesterday rocked the boat to the point where some people said, wait a minute, maybe that view is not the one you need to have. And these numbers today, even though they're not very good, are not bad enough to say it's going to force Warsh and this administration to start pulling back on this grandiose money they're throwing at people. In fact, the idea of throwing people, and you know, I don't know how I listened to about 15 people last night. All we talked to, where's he going to get the money? You dumb idiot. They're going to print it. send it out, they're going to print it. And 6 months after, inflation's going to be even higher. And they're not going to care because the rail price is up. And, oh, by the way, does anybody on this earth think that the money they got during COVID and the inflation they've got because of it was a good deal?
Yeah, well, exactly. You'll get $5,000. Unfortunately, your cost of living went up by $15.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is that you're already in a 6% fiscal deficit situation. You can put another 3.5 on that.
Yeah, what's the difference? To you and I, when Larissa, brilliant economist, teacher that she is, even she said, well, people made a really good investment in housing. You made a great investment based on what the government was going to do for the next 10 years. Nobody dreamed that that's what you were doing. You bought the house.
Well, and incidentally, the basic problem with that down the road, and this is the current debate, okay, and it's real and it's a big deal, is that, okay, that sounds great, except for one problem. Most of the people who bought those houses were boomers. They bought McMansions compared to what people used to have. Certainly, right. The stuff that was put up, you know, compared to my, you know, when I grew up. Now you have the people who are in the belly of the intelligence curve in the 1SD space and to the right of it, who are saying the forward bet on where the world's going to be 20 years hence sucks.
Yep.
Therefore, we're not having children. That takes 20 years to change if you modify people's opinions tomorrow, which, by the way, doesn't ever happen instantaneously in the history of humanity. It won't this time. Who's going to buy the house?
Well,
because oh, by the way, the boomers are starting to die. I'm on the tail end of it, all right? So I'm at the lower end. The lower end of the range is 63.
If you spent $150,000 on a house in January 2000, the house should be worth $297 today by your CPI. I'm saying $150,000 house in 2000 is a minimum $450 now.
Okay, and the problem is somebody has to pay $450.
Yeah, well, if it's another person who bought a house for $120, it's okay. They're just trading dollars. But if it's
if I kick, somebody has to pay the $450,
right,
or the price comes down. And once it starts, and I'm already seeing it here, where people got over their skis because they could take their New York salary, come down here into Tennessee where the cost of living was a third of what it is in New York, okay, and feel like gods, then they get called back to office. Like it or not, there are no $300,000 jobs here in Knoxville. They don't exist.
I'm gonna leave you with this one because I'm going to tell you, have a nice weekend for everybody, but you realize that they just graded all the states in livability?
Oh, you know what?
Just because I can give you grief about it, I'm not saying it's true. They had Tennessee as the last with an F.
Yeah, well, guess what? Every single one of those things is a complete load of crap, and I've gone through it 100 times.
Why did I know you were going to say that?
I want to know who's paying for those so-called evaluations.
But you have to understand how anxious it was for me to bring that up with you.
Listen, I will take I'll take the under on that. You know what? Everybody stay away from Tennessee. Now, incidentally, Chief, there are places where
by the way, did it work? I was so anxious to do that. Did it work?
Well, no. You know what? Hey, listen, if they're looking at
Memphis, I didn't believe it for a second.
Well, I would agree with them if they said, well, you know, don't move.
I would have guessed.
Duh. Yeah, that's an F.
I would have guessed, you know, I don't know who I would have guessed, Mississippi or someplace, but I would have guessed, I don't know, maybe West Virginia. I don't know, but I don't want to insult any state, but they had a bunch of different criteria. But I knew I could. Anyway, oh, yeah. have a nice weekend, bud. Even if you have to go fill up the buggy. SP Futures up 81, NASDAQ Futures up 345. We're celebrating something. We're not sure what, but we're celebrating. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.